This is the Future of IP Protection podcast, brought to you by MorphVision. This show is dedicated to arming companies with the skills, know-how, and technology they will need to future-proof their IP protection strategy for the years ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Future of IP Protection podcast. I'm Brandi Spence, Head of Marketing with MorphVision. Our guest today is Stephanie Martz, Chief Administrative Officer and General Counsel for the National Retail Federation. Hey, Stephanie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, I'm Brandi. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's dive right in. Why don't we start by having you tell us a bit about yourself and your background, and especially since you have, you know, extensive experience with policy and politics and legal matters. We'd love to hear about that and how you landed over at the NRF.
Sure. Happy to. How much time you got? I've had like even jokes that I've had all the jobs in Washington, and he's not far off. I am a policy generalist and not so much an IP policy or IP law specialist, but it is definitely a chunk of what I handle for the National Retail Federation, which I'll just mention now is the world's largest trade association of stores. We represent everyone from the very, very largest retailers to hundreds and hundreds of Main Street mom and pop businesses who we all know and love. So we have a really wide range of members, and I myself have served in all three branches of government. I was a law clerk as a baby lawyer for a federal judge. I worked on the Hill, actually specifically on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is where a lot of IP policy gets made. And I was in the White House, Office of White House Counsel, towards the end of President Obama's administration. And as kind of a fun aside, one of the jobs of my team was to manage the use of the White House logo and name and partnerships and on merchandise and things like that.
Wow. Well, that is certainly very impressive. You have quite the range of experience. I'm curious about something a little more personal then. What motivates and really excites you about the work that you do?
There are several things I think that are really great about the work that I do now, which I truly do love 6 years in, getting up every day and doing. First of all, I have a lot of different hats at NRF. I am the general counsel, and as the chief administrative officer, I have a lot of management responsibility. I also run our amicus brief program. Some briefs lately actually have been in the patent world, so that's been fun. I do a little lobbying, so every day is kind of a choose-your-own-adventure, which suits me well, I think. The other thing that really excites me is the fact that I get to deal with retailers every day. And, I mean, I joke, who doesn't love stores? Everybody loves stores. But the more I have learned about the retail industry, the more fascinating it is to me, because a retailer is not just a seller of goods. You have to be a marketer. You have to be an entrepreneur. You have to understand how to deal with employees. You have to be deeply invested in customer service. You have to be able to see trends around the corner and have goods in your store that your customers want, but goods that they don't know they want yet. So it's all, you know, and pricing. It's just the number of things that go into your daily algorithm are astonishing. And I love learning from our members, and I have so much respect for what they do every day. It's really fun.
Oh my gosh, I'm with you. My sister became a retailer not so long ago, right after the pandemic, and just seeing her in that journey has been very interesting to me as well. So I can only imagine when you're getting it from all sides, how fascinating that must be. Shifting gears a little bit, let's dive into the core of today's conversation around intellectual property. From your perspective, how do you see the current state of intellectual property?
I think the current state of intellectual property in the United States is positive and trending in a generally positive direction, although even that very basic question is a little bit complicated to answer, because from my members' perspective, the answer could be very different depending on how you value and monetize and use intellectual property. Some of our members are substantial rights holders at this point, especially members with really large e-commerce operations who are using AI, as many of them have been for years, to improve personalized shopping experiences, to make virtual shopping very accurate and very real, all kinds of things like that. But then we also have members, and this is probably the bulk of our members, honestly, who are primarily end users. of intellectual property. They use mobile ordering or online menus or buy online pickup in store, or the list goes on and on of patents that they have either licensed or where they're using a particular platform that they don't own, but who's a vendor to do what they need to do for their customers. And our members often get sued as end users by a category of plaintiffs known as NPEs, which are
non-practicing.
So an NPE is a non-practicing entity. The very negative term for those entities is patent trolls. I will try to stay clear of that term because it's very controversial. But in the perspective of my members, the problem is that these are plaintiffs who are holding companies that have bought up patents, many of which, in our view, are weak or vague or too abstract to really have been granted under Section 101 of the patent law. And nonetheless, we get sued because we're end users. Most recently, this is a real life example of someone who claims to hold a valid patent for online mobile ordering. And it's pretty much that vague. And so nonetheless, they sue dozens, sometimes hundreds of end users and try to extract settlement money.
And that's basically their business model, right?
Yeah. That's the whole business model. Yeah. So we got a lot of help about 10 years ago with the passage of the America Invents Act, which was a bill that was heavily negotiated and finally became law in, I think it was 2012. And one of the critical things that it did was it established a post-grant review process at the Patent and Trademark Board. So what that meant is that if you got sued, if you're a store, let's just, you know, make, well, we'll say Taco Bell because they were recently sued by this putative owner of mobile ordering technology. Yeah. If you're Taco Bell, you can look at the patent that the plaintiff is asserting and say, you know what, I think this is a really weak patent that shouldn't have been granted. This is abstract. It's just basically a claim to order food. The innovation is supposedly just that you're doing it on the internet. That's not enough. So I'm going to ask for a stay of the litigation and go to the PTAB, the Patent and Trademark Appeals Board, which is what was established by the America Invents Act, and ask for them to review this patent. And that's been enormously helpful in reducing abusive litigation in this country, especially against end users like my members. The rate of patent litigation has gone down from like a high watermark in 2012 of about 7,500 cases filed per year down to about 4,500. So that's been really, really positive. It's great to be able to go back before the patent board and have some examiners take another look at the patent and decide whether it was really a properly granted patent, whether there are certain claims that are valid, certain that should be thrown out. And it really, it just saves a lot of resources because, as you know, litigation is not the most resource efficient use of anybody's money.
No, definitely not. It just sounds so incredibly complex. This was, I'm sorry, could you repeat again? That was the American...
The America Invents Act.
Interesting. So speaking of complexity, technology continues to rapidly advance, as we talked about. So In addition to sort of pacts like these, I mean, how do you think laws governing IP are going to need to evolve and adapt in order to keep up with some of these new technology trends?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm watching with great interest how the patent system, both in the US and across the world, deals with artificial intelligence. I mean, there most recently, it's basically been established that you can't patent AI because it is machine invented, not human invented. But can you patent an algorithm that a human has at least set in motion and has probably refined over time? It seems like maybe you can. I don't know. Like, these are questions that are going to be really, really important to anyone who does anything online, including retailers, but not only retailers. So that's, I would say that the AI issue is the issue that's looming most broadly, really over everyone right now.
Yeah, so AI is definitely one of those hot topics that's really pushing the boundaries across many different industries. And let's turn over the leaf over to the question of cybersecurity, because with the rise of e-commerce and digital transformation, as you know, cybersecurity has become a major concern for retailers. How do you think brands can navigate cybersecurity regulations, and what are some practical measures that they can do in order to ensure the protection of their consumer data and their intellectual property?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think some of it is geographic dependent. There are obviously some operational security steps that you can take if you do a lot of business in China, if you do a lot of business in countries where this is a really big issue, where you need to protect all of the electronic devices that you bring, you need to really make sure that your servers have a really hard shell around them. You need to be very aware of government access to data centers and to the cloud where you keep your data. My members, very few of them operate their own clouds. And so almost all of them have contracts with one of the major or more minor cloud providers and cloud service providers. So at NRF, as with any other trade association, our primary value add is first and foremost to convene our members so that they can benchmark against each other and compare and contrast how they manage things like this and kind of come up with a formal, if NRF helps, or informal set of best practices. So, you know, what we encourage our members to do is really ask important questions of the vendors who they're dealing with. Of course, you know, we have SEC cybersecurity disclosure rules coming out that will govern publicly traded companies. And so some of that is going to drive some of the steps that publicly traded retailers are going to need to take with regard to their cybersecurity practices and procedures if they haven't done it already. And I have to say that, like most American businesses, when it comes to protecting the IP piece of this, we're all just really, really focused on where we know the bad actors are and the incredible transfer of IP and wealth from American companies to China has been remarked on many, many times. I'm not a pioneer in observing that. So we work with other trade associations on that issue. We work with the Department of Commerce, the Department of Homeland Security on that issue. We get briefed on the latest information and just really try to keep one step ahead of the game. But it's complicated. You know, we have most of my members have varying degrees of manufacturing in China. China, in many ways, has been a very good partner for our industry, but it's not without risk.
Yeah. A little bit of a two-headed snake there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you guys definitely play a central role in supporting brands. Are there any specific IP protection strategies that you would recommend for retail brands, especially those that are entering new markets?
Yeah, so I am... That's a really interesting question. When I was getting ready to talk to you, Brandy, I was thinking through what the main lenses are that my members use to look at IP. And then now this will help me answer your question. So one of them, which we already talked about, is litigation risk of IP and how to prepare for that. And we do help our members organize themselves if we see certain trends with regard to patents that are being asserted against our members. So I've already talked about that. But another issue is brand protection and counterfeits. And a third issue is how to engage in the best affirmative use of your own intellectual property, how to protect it, but also how to monetize it. So on the counterfeit issue, you know, this has been something that's been in the press quite a bit. And we have a very diverse membership. We have, among other members, a lot of brands, many of them luxury brands, for whom protecting their IP is extremely, extremely important. Of course, this isn't unique to luxury. I think the Barbie movie, which as we record this is still very hot at the box office, really points up the fact that Mattel is probably one of the great American success stories when it comes to protecting their IP and having that really be the linchpin for their incredibly successful business, right? It's just a fantastic success story. And we have plenty of other members who similarly rely on the strength of their brand and the protection that the IP law gives them to make sure that they maintain consistency, customer loyalty, and grow their market share. So, as you know better than most, Brandy, it becomes really difficult in the age of the internet when there are both the established marketplaces that we all know and many of us love, as well as marketplaces on social media and all kinds of other places that are cropping up every day. And it can be very, very difficult to police your brand, right? I mean, it's a lot of platforms to monitor. And so we do give presentations to our members on various new ideas and strategies and even services for brand protection that come into the market. There are law firms that are increasingly coming up with international strategies for protecting your brand. And sometimes we even have government regulators, you know, folks who work for Customs and Border Patrol who come and talk to our members about what they're seeing in terms of seizures and the importance of registering your mark with the government agencies who police the ports so that they know what they're looking for when they open up containers and look to see if they're a counterfeit. So there are all kinds of, you know, really dates like in the weeds, day-to-day tactics that can really help you have the tools so that you can go to places like at marketplaces where you strongly suspect or know for a fact are selling counterfeits and say to them, here is why it is abundantly clear these are not legitimate products. And, you know, having those tools in place really, really helps you protect the integrity of your brand. And then another thing that we're seeing a lot in our industry, and we really like to have our members talk to each other about and talk about their practices and what they're seeing, is licensing brands is becoming an increasingly popular way to monetize a retail business. So, for instance, there is a company out there, it's been around for quite a while now, called Authentic Brands, that over time has owned everything from images and likenesses of major sports figures like Muhammad Ali, but they also purchased the Brooks Brothers license when Brooks Brothers declared bankruptcy. It's a really, really interesting business model where a holding company, a private equity company, what have you, decides to buy brands that are very, very well known, but which might be struggling. You know, the stores themselves might be struggling with debt, might be struggling with too much real estate, that kind of thing. And what the buyer does is really decide that they're going to leverage the importance of the brand itself. And so the story really ends up being about the strength of that intellectual property and your ability to license it in a way that doesn't create a glut of product, but that is really strategic. And you can, you know, you can really help maximize revenue then from sales of that brand and kind of right size the business.
Absolutely. A very interesting take, and one that, you know, when we think about licensing, we're not necessarily thinking about those retail brands, but yeah, excellent point. So let's look forward a little bit. I'm curious about your vision. What do you see on the horizon for IP protection? And how do you envision your own advisory role sort of evolving?
You know, IP protection is just, it's really in so much flux right now. And there are so many inputs into it. And some of it is really in the weeds, ticky-tack stuff. From my members' perspective, it's as detailed as guidance that's coming from the patent office about eligibility under Section 101 of the patent law, or about discretion to implement review in the appeals board that our members, you know, really have found to be helpful and take advantage of. It's law that's developing in the federal circuit over patentability of abstract ideas, and a lot of the law that is developing in a way that's somewhat unhelpful to my members, because our view is that it is resulting in upholding patents that are abstract and vague and too broad. The problem is that those cases are really coming out of like medical testing cases and biopharma cases, where the court is really struggling with, you know, can you patent gene therapy? Can you patent a medical test that is based on genetics? Where are the lines? And if the court is holding, yes, you can patent this test or this product, sometimes the principles that the court uses to do that are so broad that they end up, you know, in my view, doing collateral damage in other areas, despite the fact that the result in that particular case might have been the right one and might have been particularly good. So there's a constant conversation on Capitol Hill about reforming and making more specific some of the elements of the patent law to give courts and the patent board a little bit more direction in terms of what should be patentable with all of these new inventions that are coming at us really quickly. And it's just, it's really, really interesting. Some of us would like to see more narrow reforms that specifically would help, you know, pharmaceuticals and other patent holders would like to see very, very broad reforms that clarify that, you know, basically the default is that you should be able to get a patent and let the cards fall where they may, whether that patent is a strong one or a weak one. So it's just, there's a lot going on right now. There's, from a lawyer's perspective, there's an awful lot of precedent to pay attention to. This is a very inventive time, and businesses, including retail, are changing really fast.
It truly is amazing. And there are some things that you mentioned that, you know, I'm always wondering, okay, IP protection, you know, is necessary, right? Patents, trademarks, whatever it is, your trade secrets, whatever that is, you know, you've got to protect that. But, you know, you add that component that sometimes can stifle innovation too, right? And so, like, if the laws become too strict, then I get it. Sometimes these, you know, you got to issue these patents, but possibly that could, you know, not open up the opportunity for others then to take that and be more innovative. So not that that's right or wrong. It's just a very tricky situation. It's going to be very interesting to continue watching.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you started off asking about the balance between innovation and protection. And there are so many inputs into that balance, but that balance is the issue, right? You know, and if you're primarily an end user of patents, really strong patent protection, regardless of the claims in that particular patent, looks like it's going to stifle innovation for you, you know, because if you are a regional restaurant chain in the upper Midwest, you're never going to be the company that invests a lot in developing your own IP. You are relying on buying technology to do the reservation system and the ordering system and inventory management and all of that. And if all of a sudden you're subject to suit from, you know, three different NPEs in the Eastern District of Texas, that starts to look like it's going to throttle your innovation.
Yeah. Interesting. We'll be watching for sure and to see how everything, you know, sort of moves forward. It's going to be an interesting future for IP protection for sure. Well, before we wrap up, I'd love to hear some actionable advice from you. Are there perhaps three pieces of advice that you could leave our listeners with today as they prepare on their own IP challenges ahead?
I would say, first of all, if you are a company that is very dependent on your particular brand, and that's one of the chief sources of your monetization, make sure that you are really up to date on the state-of-the-art ways that you can protect your brand and protect against counterfeits out there. There are lots of really good solutions on the market. And so I would say, like, that's one really important takeaway that folks should look at. Number two, join an association of other similarly situated businesses. You know, if you're a retailer, join NRF. We have great resources and great conversations, and we can help situate you within the context of other lawsuits that are being filed, of what other retailers are seeing. And as many listeners probably know, there's a trade association for everything out there. So you can definitely find one. And the third thing that I would say is, I guess, keep up to date from time to time with what's going on in Washington. You know, patent law is primarily a federal issue. The executive branch has a lot of authority over it. Congress certainly has a lot of authority over it. So take a look. Use the Googles. To use a protected term, and take a look at what's going on with IP policy, familiarize yourself a little bit about what's going on at the patent office, because I think it'll really help give you just a little bit of context into what you might be seeing with regard to your own portfolio.
For sure. Staying informed is so key. And to your first two points, I mean, you've got, you know, organizations such as the NRF and others that can certainly help you stay informed as well and provide you some key information. And I think, you know, your two points in terms of using technology or service providers that can help and organizations that can help you just goes to the point of being very collaborative, because it is a very...
Exactly. It's whack-a-mole otherwise.
It is. It is. And you can't go at this alone. There are many, many tools in the toolbox and many other brands or retailers themselves that can help with, you know, their own expertise. So really good pieces of advice there. So thank you, Stephanie. Unfortunately, it is all the time we have to cover today, but I think this has been very insightful. Before we end it here, can you tell our listeners, if they want to follow up, get in touch with you, or even learn more about NRF, where would be the best place for them to go?
Absolutely. I'm just going to give you my email, because if you're listening to this, you're probably a little bit of an IP geek, and I would be happy to hear from you. My email is martzs@nrf.com. Shoot me an email.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for your time, Stephanie. I really enjoyed this conversation. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope to have you back with us for future episodes of The Future of IP Protection.
Thanks for listening to The Future of IP Protection podcast, brought to you by Mark Vision. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you'd like to learn more about how Mark Vision can help you transform your IP protection strategy, visit us at markvision.com. Thanks again, and I'll catch you on the next episode.